Hello and welcome to The Lockdown. This is your fortnightly podcast all about prisons and the criminal justice system in Britain. I'm Una Ryder, I'm at Unski on Twitter.
And I'm Sam Swan, at Sam G Swan on Twitter, the resident idiot looking to learn more about the criminal justice system and how to abolish prisons. We're also joined by another expert, Luke Billingham from Haven Distribution, a charity that has been purchasing and distributing books for prisoners since 1996. Hello.
Indeed. Hello. I'm glad you didn't make me mention my Twitter handle, because my Twitter's shite. So I wouldn't want it known.
You're not got good Twitter game?
No.
Well, get good Twitter game.
I've got decent Twitter game for Haven, about Haven.
Oh, that's cool. Follow Haven on Twitter,
but,
then.
Yeah, at Haven Distrib. But my own one is just like me looking smiley and then like three retweets and that's about it.
Sounds nice. I think Twitter needs more of that.
Yeah, just silence. Yeah.
Be a much better place. So I guess we're just going to kick off with, can you tell us what does Haven Distribution do and why?
Yes. So as Sam said, Haven is all about sending books to prisoners. Specifically, the core of what we do is sending educational books. So any prisoner studying any course can fill out a simple application form and get a book from us. So we support vocational courses, functional skills courses, and then all the way up to like postgrad courses like master's degrees. And then we've got a few different catalogues with general reading books and different types of books, mostly donated by publishers. So any prisoner at all can get hold of our catalogue, write to us and receive a book from our catalogue. And we have a few sort of like side projects. So we recently fundraised because of a request from Whitemore to send in children's books. So we've raised the money and sent children's books into Whitemore so that the dads in Whitemore can give their kids books for Christmas.
Oh, amazing.
So me and one of the other people from Haven are going along to their family visit day on the 21st of December to sort of be a bit of a part of it. So
great.
That's cool.
And why did you get involved specifically? How long have you been working with Haven?
Almost 3 years now. And I first got involved during the book ban. And that was a sort of key motivator for me.
So can you explain what the book ban was for anyone?
Yeah,
who doesn't know?
So it was when Chris Grayling was Justice Minister.
Boo.
he did a whole raft of things which were terrible. And one of the things he did was, it was slightly technical, he like banned packages being sent into prison, and I think it was a certain type of packages, or all packages, but including books. So it just became known as the book ban, which obviously was a stupid idea, and became very controversial very quickly, and he had to spend...
Was that in 2012?
I knew you were going to ask me. no, it was later than that. It was like 2014, 2015.
Okay, yeah.
Because then Gove came in and got rid of it quite quickly. And I think that was early 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, December 2015.
Okay.
That's when he got rid of it.
Okay.
But what, why?
You're supposed to be the resident idiot, Sam.
Oh, sorry. Shut up with the research.
Yeah, stop exhibiting knowledge. That's not your role.
Why the hell did he want to ban books?
There's a couple of reasons, I guess. The first one was sort of security. Like, they were obviously scared about what goes into prisons and what could be hidden in different packages.
Smuggling abolition texts in, I imagine.
Less that, more like you can soak pages in drugs or whatever, like different clever ways that things can be done. I think they were spooked about that. Even though they obviously check all packages coming in very carefully, they've obviously lifted the book ban because they know that the security measures are good enough, and there's obviously lots of other ways that stuff gets into prisons aside from posting through the mail. The other reason was the basic sort of old school right wing ideas about what prisoners do and don't deserve to have. So that was sometimes used, the idea that prisoners don't deserve to receive packages or receive books. And then the third one was sort of bollocks about the quality of prison libraries or the easy accessibility of books in prison aside from being sent them in. So some politicians were saying that prisoners have the same library service as everyone else, so it's all fine. In prisons it varies greatly, but in general, I mean, Charlie Gilmore said it was just Jeffrey Archer when he got to his prison library, and it took him a while to get there.
So what's the current situation in prisons? Like, how easy is it actually to access books, if there are books there? Do you know what I mean? More than just Jeffrey Archer's books.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, the important thing about the lifting of the book ban is that it doesn't then mean that prisoners can get hold of loads of different books whenever they want it. Both during and after the book ban, the fact remained that the main source of books for prisoners was the prison library. Not all prisoners have loads of people on the outside sending them in books the whole time. And prison libraries vary in terms of the resources that they have, and so the range of books that they've got. And they also vary in terms of the access that prisoners can have to them. So often it's like an hour a month, sometimes less than that. And obviously bang up. So prisoners being locked in their cells is on the increase. And in many prisons, it's sort of 23 hours a day plus that you're banged up in your cell. So you don't have much access to library or to educational classes. So one of the aspects of what we do that's becoming more and more important is that we send books directly to prisoners for them to own. So if you've got your own book that is yours to have in your cell, you've got constant access to it. And if you're studying a course, that's enormously important. If you're only getting to a class every now and again, if you only get into the library very rarely, then obviously that course, that study is massively sort of sporadic. Whereas if you've got an important textbook with you in your cell, then even if you're banged up for 23 hours, not that that's ever good, but if that does happen, you've got that resource with you. So study becomes a continuous, consistent activity rather than this annoyingly sporadic thing.
Yeah.
That kind of relates to, there was a podcast I was listening to recently on Love and Radio, which you should subscribe to if you've never listened to. And it was all about Albert Woodfox, who was a US ex-prisoner, and he was held in solitary confinement for 44 years. He was only released in 2016. So he was part of the Angola Three who were framed for the murder of a prison guard in response to their Black Panther activism in prison. Angola is the name of a prison in the US, and it's called Angola because it used to be a slave plantation and was named after, obviously, the source of the slaves that worked there. So he talks a lot about reading on this podcast and how significant it was for him in kind of staying sane and maintaining a connection to the outside world and to kind of a future. And I wanted to just read this quote from him. He said, "We couldn't travel physically, but we could travel philosophically and intellectually from one end of the planet to another. The cells that were meant to be death chambers became schools and debate halls. We taught ourselves history, geography, math. We taught ourselves the law, and that became one of the many tools we used to bring about change in Angola." Obviously, for those three men that were in solitary confinement for 44 years, that was their main connection to the world. And I think it's quite interesting as well. Black Panthers had a required reading list for party members. That was such a fundamental part of the activism that they did.
Yeah.
What, just wanted to ask you, what do you think the significance of reading is for prisoners?
Well, our main sort of insight into what books can do comes from the letters that we get from the prisoners who've received our books. And it's worth saying that over half of the books that we send in are dictionaries of some description. Mm. So either a normal dictionary or a dictionary in thesaurus or a bilingual dictionary for people who don't speak English as a first language.
Mm.
So often what we hear in terms of what the book's done is just helped with the development of literacy and English literacy. And as we know, in general, on average, in prisons, levels of literacy tend to be quite low. So it makes a massive difference, again, to have a dictionary that you can have in your cell. So you're constantly developing your literacy. So we get lots of letters saying that. It's helped enormously in the development of reading and writing. Again, on a sort of practical note, we get lots of letters saying that the books have helped with achieving particular qualifications or succeeding in particular courses. And then in a sort of slightly loftier way, more along the lines of that quote, we hear people describing how books can bring hope, can bring purpose, can bring focus, all those things which tend to be lacking often in prisons, which can be quite directionless, monotonous places. And people talk about, you know, as that quote says, about like traveling in some way and about a certain type of escape. As I think I'll probably mention later, it's important to say that books don't make people free well, they only make people free in a certain sense, potentially intellectually. Like you can exercise a certain freedom of mind through books, but they don't make people free.
So you kind of want to be careful of like glorifying the idea of exactly. like escapism through books.
Yeah.
It's kind of like then, monk-like but
it,
existence.
But it does bring communication with the outside, which prisoners often talk about. So like we've sent in quite a few books this month in December. And so we've got loads of letters back saying, this is the only Christmas present I'll get. So thanks.
Mm.
And that sort of thing where if you've you know, done certain things which might be quite horrible, then you're likely to be cut off from your family.
Yeah.
And obviously it varies massively by sentence and by individual according like the connection you have with family and friends on the outside. But sometimes the connection you have with the outside world is very minimal. So like receiving a book from us has that element of like communication from the outside, which makes a difference. There's talk as well about like debate and discussion prompted by our books, which we always like to hear. So there was a guy who was saying about how our books have become tatty because they're passing it around the wing and then they're all like debating about it. And he said something like, debate is in depressingly short supply, but our books help to prompt it, which is cool.
Wow.
And then also like peer support. Peer support's a massive part of education in prisons. So a charity called the Shannon Trust trains up prisoners to train other prisoners to read. But in loads of educational classes, there's lots of prisoners helping others. And we got one of the best letters we've ever got was from a guy who said the first book he ever possessed was an English to Polish dictionary that we sent him. And he's now a peer supporter in a maths class. And so he's writing to like ask us to send books to him to give to his class effectively.
Amazing.
So that sort of thing is pretty cool. And then we've had letters about the effect of the smoking ban and saying that our books have helped with that, or like someone had toothache because they'd been to the dentist and had a bit of a shoddy job and the books was the main distraction that they had.
Could you just elaborate slightly on a thing you've said before about tools and windows? I think it's really cool.
All right, you're enforcing pretension on me. when we're being mildly theoretical, we talk about books as tools and windows. So as I say, books have an enormously important practical utility if you're inside and you're getting sporadic education, and the educational resources in prisons are often minimal because of budget issues and so on. So we have a lot of good relationships with tutors who sort of apply to us on behalf of their prisoners, or get their students to apply to us because of a lack of resources. And so in that situation where education is incredibly difficult, books are the best tools really to help with education. So we're sending in the sort of tools of education. And then on the windows side, as I said, books can't make you free if you're locked in a cell, but what they can do is give some sort of intellectual windows onto the outside world in a way which can make a massive difference to what it's like to be in a cell.
Brilliant. So we mentioned Chris Grayling before, and then the man who replaced him, Michael Gove, who, as considering how hated he was by everyone in education, he seems to have been embraced a little bit more. I mean, maybe that's a strong word.
Yeah. So I trained as a teacher, and when I was trained as a teacher, Gove was in education, and he was the devil, the hate figure, almost to the extent that it was annoying because the amount of shite jokes that were made about isn't Gove a wanker with just getting boring. But he was sort of mildly celebrated it when he went to the Ministry of Justice, basically because, to speak metaphorically, Grayling had done a massive turd on the prison system, and then Gove sort of scooped up some, if not all, of that turd, and then probably had a few ideas of his own that I don't know that much about, but it seemed like mostly his actions were remedial, was sort of trying to address some of the terrible shite which Grayling had done.
He also wasn't really in post long enough to, kind of
less than a year
to do any damage. I think it was less than a year, wasn't it? Because of the referendum.
But I mean, he's like, I mean, we might talk about his ideas about education. And obviously in the context of schools, they've been controversial for lots of good reasons, but in a very generic sense, he banged on about education and the importance of education in prisons. And despite the tone of that and the angle from which he was coming not being the best, he was at least banging the drum for education.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, he was a breath of fresh air in the stuff he was saying, in that it just, like, wasn't completely condemning prisoners. I mean, I'll also, like, qualify that with that he was continuing down this route of, like, building more prisons and being very punitive in policy ways, but in his rhetoric it was a little bit refreshing.
How dangerous is it, and where could we end up if we talk a lot about, you know, the right-wing narratives of deficiencies in these individuals and how to kind of rehabilitate people? Like, what does that do? Where does that get us?
Well, I think in general, if you're involved in any sort of education, the question arises of what is education for? And there's a sort of, like, Govian approach which borders on the idea of, like, a civilizing mission. So, like, education is the equivalent of visiting a colony and, like, bringing your civilization to it. And there's examples of that in the history of British education, when, you know, Etonians went to Hackneywick, near where I grew up, with an enormously patronising view of civilising that slummy area. Through education, through religion, through many things.
We did actually talk in one of our previous podcasts about the parallels and the relationship between British colonialism and the criminal justice system here and those discourses. Yeah,
and there's plenty of them. And then so that's, like, one extreme of educational theory. And then the other side is more like empowering idea of education as something which can emancipate people, make them sort of intellectually free, so more like a sort of Paulo Freire idea. He wrote a famous book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is, like, really celebrated in sort of lefty educational circles. And so, I mean, I think it's fair to say that us at Haven are closer to the Freire than the Gove. And education can obviously do lots of very good things in terms of promoting critical analysis, self-development, sort of history making, in the sense of, like, as I mentioned, I trained as a teacher, and I wrote a paper about the power of learning about contingency in terms of historical contingency. So not in a wanky, like, Jacques Derrida, everything's a text, everything's contingent, we're just, like, running around in contingency, but an empirical, practical, historical way. If you look at the history of the NHS, like, to what extent was it vulnerable at the start? To what extent has it been vulnerable since? Why has it been vulnerable? What's been done to it? What keeps it going? So looking at the extent to which things are sort of inevitable and fixed, or the extent to which they're contingent. And that can be massively empowering, because you're looking at how you, or how different forces can influence history, and the extent to which history is open. And if you learn about that, then that's one of the best tools you can have intellectually for then trying to change things.
I mean, that's very much along the lines of what Albert Woodfox was saying, is it kind of gave him this intellectual, philosophical growth, that window into the world. But ultimately that was used to change the physical conditions of the prison that they were in, and to kind of find a way to organize themselves to that struggle that actually, you know, if you think about it, seems impossible. Like, three guys in segregation.
When I wrote the paper, I had quite a nice sentence that, again, was mildly pretentious, but I was quite happy with. It was something like, if you know about contingency, it helps prevent you from being passively acquiescent in the face of what you should challenge, complacent about what you should defend, and unable to tell the difference. So if you've got no awareness of contingency, of the extent to which things may or may not be sort of fixed, may or may not be sort of stubborn forces in the world, then you end up being acquiescent in the face of what you should be challenging, complacent in about things that might be vulnerable and you should be defending, and unable to tell the difference, both in terms of empirically what's changeable and not, and sort of, like, morally what you would want to change if you were more informed about it. That's my pretentious little thing that I forgot.
It's great. I love it. I wanted to talk a little bit, I mean, we've kind of chatted a bit about it, about this kind of instrumentalization of education. What is education for? It seems to me that primarily education is treated in a very instrumental way in prisons at the moment. If you talk to prisoners, they'll often have spent, like, years doing, like, level one English and maths, like, over and over again. And the setup is that these services are contracted out to private providers. And those providers get paid each time someone completes a qualification. So the incentive that creates is that it's actually, it makes more sense to have someone who's done that qualification before, because they're going to get better results. I was wondering kind of where you see Haven in in maybe like countering some of that.
It's a massive problem which we as a sort of provider of books can't really tackle too strongly, but there's a massive issue in the gap between like level 1 and 2 functional skills courses and then like degree level. So there's not that much, it doesn't seem to be loads of sort of GCSE A level type courses to bridge that gap. So we provide loads of dictionaries for functional skills courses. We provide quite a lot of sort of advanced textbooks for like Open University degree courses. And then we provide as many A-level books as we're asked for, but it's noticeable that there's fewer of those. So we do all that we can in that we support all educational courses as much as we can, including those ones which are an effective bridge and an effective level up. But we know that there's a massive issue and massive frustration when you do a level 2 course and then there's nowhere really to go. And plenty of people do courses just as something to do. So plenty of people go into... It's important to emphasise that prisons are massively diverse places. So some prisoners go in with low levels of literacy, some go in with high qualifications, some are able to progress enormously and end up doing degrees inside. But those who go into prisons with higher qualifications than level 2 might end up doing level 2s just as something to do and just to get them out of their cell. So aside from massive lack of resources, aside from being banged up so you might not be able to get to your classroom, the way that courses are set up in prisons as well can prevent it from being as worthwhile as you'd want education to be.
Yeah, definitely. It seems so inefficient. So we were talking about this on our first podcast. It was about privatisation.
Yeah.
It's just to be spending that much money. I think it's 5.5 million on education a year, and to be essentially getting people just going around on that side. I met a guy recently who'd done level 1 English and maths 8 times in his sentence. It just seems, it's just bizarre, really. But should we move on to argument ammo?
We definitely should. So argument ammo is the bit where we might try to provide answers that the kind of general public might ask, those sort of questions that you might have on the street. Although, as Luke pointed out before, also idiot politicians, actually.
I think it's there's a problem in certain sections of the left of dismissing the general public and basically being aloof, patronising twonks towards ordinary people in a way that is just complete anathema to everything that the left should be about. So, like, using this as an example, not having a go at you guys, but a lot of the things that come under the argument ammo statements are more likely to be said by politicians. And as I think was mentioned in a previous podcast that you guys did, the general public are actually probably tend to be more informed, or research has shown they're more informed and less sort of right wing about prisons than politicians / certain sections of the media.
Yeah.
So like taking the Sun as an example, you can bitch about the Sun all you want, but the moment you start suggesting that all Sun readers are like these complete idiots, you're making the wrong argument, and you're only going to come across as a liberal metropolitan elite flat white sipping novel. And it's in terms of the success of the left, there is a genuine issue with coming across too much like that and pissing off precisely the sort of people who need to be engaged.
I think that's partly why we want to do this section as well. The argument ammo section is the idea that you've got to meet people where they are. You can't just kind of dismiss, like, I don't want to say the words legitimate concerns. But anyway, we should change
there
this.
Something like almost half of the people in prisons have done something really minor and are in for less than 6 months and they're on stupid short sentences. And it's ridiculous. And short sentences should be got rid of. And it's worth emphasising again and again, loads of people in prison who've done nothing major, might be innocent, it's ridiculous. But there are a small number of people in prisons who've done undeniably horrific things.
Mm.
And therefore, people have very strong emotive opinions about what they've done. Rightly so. If somebody's a rapist, if somebody's a serial killer, it's justifiable to be not particularly happy with what they've done. And then you have to make better, subtler, intelligent arguments about what should be done with them in the face of people's justifiable anger in the direction of those people. And there's too much avoidance on the left of the fact that some people do horrible things, are caught doing horrible things, and then go to prison. Far too many people do something very minor and end up in prison. Far too many people are innocent and end up in prison. Far too many people are on remand, so legally innocent, get chucked in a prison with everyone else. They just have a bit more canteen and they just get a bit more prison visits, but they're legally innocent, they get chucked in, and then terrible things happen to them while they're inside and they get criminalized. All those things are true. But if we're going to have argument ammo, if we're going to effectively argue against the right, we have to have a decent response for the most frequently used example by the right, which is people who've committed rapes or sexual offences or murders. That is a small proportion of the prison population, but we have to face up to that argument.
Definitely.
If we're going to...
And by loads on the left that we've spoken to as well.
Yeah, definitely. So, but if you do want some argument ammo for some of those questions, our previous podcast, if you haven't listened to it, with the wonderful David Scott, addresses some of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So our with all that, quite a lot of pressure now on the first question. So the question for Ulrich is, prisoners don't deserve books. Why should they get free education when uni fees are $9,000 a year? Though,
so a number of things. Firstly, very quick point, there shouldn't be 9k fees for anyone. Education should be free outside and inside. I've had one Twitter argument in my life.
Well done.
And it was with somebody. I'd tweeted something about supporting a guy who's doing a master's course, and the tweet came back saying something like, it's all very well to support them, but there isn't enough support for people on the outside doing master's courses. Sort of like, why should we be supporting them? And I responded, yeah, it's bad that there isn't more support for people doing master's on the outside. It's bad that there are fees. That doesn't mean you shouldn't support people on the inside who are doing master's degrees. And people who are doing master's degrees on the inside do have to pay fees. It's only thanks to organisations like the Longford Trust and the Prisons Education Trust that they're able to do them in the first place. And there's also the point about how whatever your political opinion, even if you're a civilizing mission type view when it comes to education, then education has a role in rehabilitation. And so even if we're self-interested right-wing people, education can support reoffending, can reduce crime. So it's probably pretty good if they're doing that in prisons. And also there's the point that if you're in prison, the likelihood is that you've been let down by the education system somewhere along the way, be it in a mainstream school, in a children's home, in a secure children's home, secure training center, pupil referral unit, young offenders institution. All those places have an educational remit, and too often they fail to deliver it. So there's a sort of remedial role which prisons can quite rightly serve, where they should give really good education and a lot of it, because plenty of the people who are in there are in there partly because of failures in previous institutions which should have given them a decent education. And then lastly, sorry, I realise I'm rambling, there's the wider point. So the whole prisoners don't deserve books is a bit similar to the prisoners don't deserve PlayStations or prisoners don't deserve TVs. And the thing that, again, getting mildly pretentious, the thing that I think about that is that people can sort of suggest, like, if a prisoner's got a book or a TV or a PlayStation, they're just as free and their life is just as good as people on the outside. And I think that speaks more to a sort of degeneration of ideas of liberty and ideas of a worthwhile life on the outside than it does to anything else. Like, if you think concretely about the details of a prisoner's life, they're banged up for 23 hours. They're likely to be in a cell which has a toilet in it, which is unscreened. They're probably in with somebody else in an incredibly confined space. They can't see the people they love. They can't influence the outside world. They can't influence politics. There's limits to their self-expression. That's what liberty means. Like, all of those things are what freedom has meant politically for like a number of centuries. Mm. They're not free. If they have a PlayStation, if they have a book, they're not free. Mm. If you're in a cell for 23 hours a day, whether you got a book, whether you got a PlayStation, whether you got a jacuzzi, you're not free. And also, with things like PlayStations, they have a role in keeping people quiet. You're more likely to be able to successfully keep someone in a cell banged up for 23 hours if they've got a PlayStation or if they've got a TV. So there's a bit of a sort of placating role that those things have, which I think is important to mention when people are going on the whole prisoners have it so good show.
Yeah. Those are good answers. Mm. See, we do this sometimes with just me and Sam, and I always get all philosophical and not very straightforward. I was like, oh, but what even are books?
Yeah. If you had somebody who read too much Derrida, I'm sure they could talk for ages about what a book is.
But I like to be asking the questions. My question is, it's not even really a question, but prisoners are lazy and they don't even care about education. And that's why they're in prison in the first place. So why do you bother?
So firstly, just repeating what I said before, the issue more often is that they've been excluded, left out in terms of the educational provision that they should have been getting earlier in their lives. And that can be as, you know, horrific as having grown up in care in children's homes that don't have any educational provision so having a real, real lack of education in a way that's quite unusual, or it can be something as more often happens of being in a school which doesn't provide the care that it should provide and then end up being excluded from school, pupil referral unit, and your education being affected in that way. There's loads of different ways that people and prisoners can have their education affected earlier in life. We get letters every week telling us of bloody amazing stuff that's been done by prisoners just with the aid of a couple of books. And if you're in prison in general, you're in a pretty bad situation, and the sort of stuff that people are able to do with one book is the opposite of lazy. And also, if they are lazy and they don't care about education, why don't we try and persuade them that it's worthwhile and see if we can help to encourage an enjoyment of education rather than just calling them lazy and leaving them.
Have you got any examples?
Yeah.
Examples of what, sorry?
Of what people have done with
books. One book.
Cool stuff.
So check out @haven_district, didn't mention the underscore before, for excellent letters of what people have done. But I mean, the example I gave earlier of the guy who received his first ever book from us and then became a peer supporter is a good one. There's a guy who's due to get a first in his degree, who's had a variety of support but had some a few books from us. So compared to most people who end up with firsts, his resources were titchy, and he's going for that. Someone got a Kersler Trust art prize. So that's an art prize that exists for those in secure environments. He'd got a book from us, which is an art book, and he just used that book, developed his technique, did a bloody good picture of a flower, and got an art prize. And the list goes on. And I think probably the most impressive thing is when people self-educate. So don't have that much educational input from librarians or from teachers because they don't get to see them enough. And so they've got a book in their cell and they self-educate and do amazing things.
Mm. I think the work of, you mentioned the Shannon Trust earlier, who do kind of peer support, they train people up. They train people in prison up to help other people in prison to learn to read, and the motivation of the peer mentors that work with them, I think, just show you like how much prisoners can do and how motivated they are.
Yeah, definitely. And it's obviously something about the sort of horizontal power relation between different prisoners when they're helping each other, rather than some aloof educator trying to impose things. And obviously I'm not saying that all tuition is a bad thing, but the sort of horizontal power relationship adds a certain element to it, which can help if people are disengaged initially.
Mm. Particularly for people who've already had pretty awful educational experiences.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And
So our final one is one from the left. which is, as abolitionists, we shouldn't get involved in the system, though, should we?
Firstly, I think it's important that, I think every argument, Amma, you should have some shite from the left as well as shite from the right, because it is important to note that there is a fair amount of shite in the left as well.
Great feedback.
I've got a big general point, and then I'll narrow it down to criminal justice system. So the big general point is that too many people on the left have a sort of retreatist, quietist, ponderous approach to politics, where they've read a bit of Adorno or a bit of Zizek, and they think that the most radical thing to do is sit about reading and gathering as many radical ideas in your head as possible whilst doing shit all in the real world. And sometimes it's justified because you don't want to be complicit in anything, because everything's bad. So don't be complicit in anything, just do shit all. And that's how to be a radical. Obviously missing the fact that the greatest figures of the left intellectually were also doing shit, like your Gramsci's, your Marx, Foucault. They were doing stuff as well as writing, and it enriched their writing as well as them doing things. And there's a confusion sometimes between radical ideas and radical politics. Like, different people have different ideas about Derrida, but to say, what is it, the whole world is a text or something like that, that's a radical theoretical proposition, which is a bit different from common sense. That doesn't necessarily make it a radical political position. And so many on the left, especially in academia, seem to confuse those and find something that's really interestingly radical in a theoretical way, and then think, therefore, it must be politically left-wing. Anyway, back to the criminal justice system. I just think that whole retreatist position is particularly indefensible when it comes to the criminal justice system. So a lefty might think we shouldn't get involved at all in anything in the criminal justice system, because the moment we dip our foot in it, we're helping to continue it as it is. And what we should do as sort of pseudo-Leninists is like let it begin to crumble and then do some sort of revolution. Whereas in actual fact, the situation, in my view, is so terrible in prisons. There are 85,000 people roughly in our prisons, many of them, again, on remand, who are legally innocent. And the rates of self-harm, suicide, violence, bullying, the lack of education, the bang-up is horrendous. And if you add on the amount of families that affects of prisoners, if you add on the staff, whatever your view on prison staff, they have a horrible job often. Some of them do amazing things. Some of them are assholes by all accounts. But they have to, they're workers and their conditions are bad. Mm. So if you add them into the mix as well, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people who are experiencing this horrible crisis. And at the same time, yesterday in Parliament, there was a debate about prisons. There was like 17, 20 MPs there. So the inaction from politicians in the face of this horrible situation necessitates anyone who claims to be at all lefty and at all interested in criminal justice to do some stuff. If you've got the bit of time and you've got a bit of ability, write to your MP about your local prison, sign a petition, look at a list of charities and see which ones you might be able to get involved in. Do a bit of mentoring or befriending if you're able to. There are good schemes doing that. Support Reclaim Holloway. Support the campaign against super prisons. There's a whole raft of things that you can do if you're interested in bettering the condition of those who are affected by the prison crisis. So sitting on your hands because you don't want to be complicit in anything, I think, is quite indefensible. Because you can do quite a lot, given the wide range of things that is available to do to have some sort of impact on the criminal justice system, and then still find time on the weekend for a bit of Foucault or Deleuze and Guattari or whatever you want. And a lot of lefties spend so much time in sort of echo chamber debates about the minutiae of some French philosopher or Frankfurt School fella or woman, when there's work to be done.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked quite a bit on previous podcasts about the kind of the role of the prison in creating like disposable populations, really, and the importance of, as abolitionists, being involved in the day-to-day task of reaffirming the humanity of people in prison, reaffirming their worth. And one of the most important things is actually trying to change the concrete conditions that they're in. David Scott, I think, was talking about on our previous podcast, was talking about non-reformist reforms, is making sure when you're making reforms, it's reductionist. It's about those material conditions, but you're making sure that you're not expanding the justice system.
And yeah, I think you shouldn't be an armchair abolitionist. And even if you're not at all abolitionist, like, to be honest, my view on prisons is a much more practical one because of being directly involved in Haven. I want to send a shitload of books to prison and thereby help prison education. And my reading and thinking about this isn't as good as it should be. Like, I'm doing stuff and I'll try and find time for reading. But even if you're just a reformist, even if you're quite conservative, the conditions are so bad that you shouldn't even be an armchair reformist. Like, stuff needs to be done. And a whole wide spectrum of people politically are aware of this and are trying to do stuff. So,
yeah.
Join in.
Hear that, the left?
Yeah, yeah.
Buck your ideas up.
I love that you're from a charity that distributes books and you're saying put down books and go and do stuff.
That's I hadn't thought of that, actually. Yeah, put down books and send them in instead.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, if you've got a... Yeah, I shouldn't go on about cultural theorists as if there's something wrong with that. But if if you've read your Foucault and stuff, you're clearly at a high enough level of education to get on with things. So put down the books and send in books to prisons instead.
Great message.
Amazing.
So just to finish off, we always do a what can you do section if you want to get involved in this and stop being an armchair abolitionist or reformist.
Which I love that you like set up for us.
Yeah. Anyway.
And that was pre-planned.
Yeah.
There's no way that we can prove it, but it genuinely was not pre-planned.
So our what you can do section actually comes from Luke again. He's just waltzing in here.
Like, taking over the podcast.
Do you want to just host it?
I think I'm far too rambly to host anything. So, I mean, I think Haven's pretty good, so you can support what we do. And what we really want, actually, specifically, is a dictionary publisher to donate us a load of books, because we send in so many dictionaries, and we've tried before to get a publisher to send us loads of dictionaries, and we haven't got that far. And what we need is the smallest dictionaries possible to minimise postage costs. So if there's a publisher that does small paperback dictionaries and they donate us like thousands, that would save us loads of money, and then we'd be able to send in loads and loads more books. So that's the sort of Haven side of it. And then there's all sorts of different organizations which I love, like Shannon Trust, Longford Trust, Prisoners Education Trust, who are obviously around prison education. There's a cool group called Learning Together where they get university students to go into prisons to study a course with prisoners. So supporting those organizations would be good. There's all sorts of different things you can do. Trailblazers and Newbridge are a way in which you can mentor or befriend prisoners. And then the Longford Trust do a scheme where you can mentor ex-prisoners who want to do a degree. So they've funded them inside, the Longford Trust have, and then they're aware that when they leave, they might be sort of a bit lost educationally. So they fund the person to do a degree once they're out, but they get people to mentor the prisoners like through their degree. So anyone who's educated at degree level, I think could potentially be well suited to that. So there's lots of stuff that can be done. And what I've advocated is the creation of a web page by you two with a long list of stuff that can be done. And in the meantime, Una knows a shitload. So send Una a Twitter message and be like, what can I do? And then, like, send your CV, and then Una can tell you what to do.
Cool. Cheers, Luke. Yeah. Give me a load of work to do. Excellent.
It's that whole web page.
Yeah. We'll work on the web page.
I've blackmailed you.
If you can just host the podcast, and we'll get working on the web page. That's
on the
cool.
admin.
Okay, great. Well, we'll leave it there. But thank you.
Thanks,
Luke.
So much, mate.
No worries. Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so subscribe to the podcast, listen to us, we'll be back in a couple of weeks. And if you want to tell us what you thought of the show, we are at
The Lockdown Pod on Twitter.
We'll edit one of those out.
That's cool. Fresh.
Okay, that's us.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye. Laters.
This show is brought to you by Novara Media. To find articles, videos, and more audio content like this, head to novaramedia.com. If you particularly enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen to it, why not head to iTunes? And as well as subscribing, leave us a review. Navara Media can only exist thanks to subscribers and supporters. If you have the means, please consider subscribing at support.navaramedia.com. As well as helping us continue to produce regular content, subscribers will also receive priority access to events as well as promotions throughout the year. For regular updates, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Navara Media, media for a different politics.